friends and past and beyond. Let's see those who weren't with us too long. Life is the most precious thing you can lose. While you were here, the fun was never ending. Life a minute was only beginning. Captain Coleman Nagle, this one's for you! And you can go on. Just remember, your side it is a cheer on. You've got friends with you till the end. If you're ever in a tough situation, we'll be there, no hesitation. Brotherhood's our rule, we cannot bend.
And welcome back to Dr. Drill's Making Motivation Podcast, where it is our mission to honor interesting and authentic people by telling their motivating stories. In the process, we hope to inform and inspire, put some smiles on faces, and a little fire under the asses of the masses. Today is Sunday, March 22nd in the year 2024. I've got a great friend of mine, Jay Hool, with me. He's a former Marine, UE mechanic. He's going to tell us all about that. We grew up together in the Pine Barrens in New Jersey, and so have tremendous background together and million stories to tell. And we've already decided that and gotten consent from some of the old crew that we're going to get on here together. We can fit as many as 10 people on here. So that will be very beneficial, I think, for all of us. Be interesting, should be funny. And would represent a return to our beginnings. Okay. Also, Jay's going to share a little bit about what it's like having a son in the United States Marine Corps. He's come full circle now. And so here we friggin' go, motivators. Friggin' little context. I grew up at Jay in the Pine Barrens. We were part of a tight-knit group of friends who were always together, surfing, drinking beer, and otherwise carrying on. We remain great friends to this day through our busy lot, though our busy lives don't offer the freedom of jumping in the truck and heading down to LBI to hit the waves. Following high school graduation, Jay, myself, and several other friends joined the Marine Corps. This is Jay's account of his USMC service and up to the present day. And welcome, Jay.
Thank you. How you doing, Aaron?
I'm good, my brother. It's great to see you.
You too.
Talk to you. Appreciate you spending this time with me.
Absolutely.
So let's start at the beginning, man. Growing up back in the block, what was it like growing up in the Pine Barrens? And you can speak to our friendship and our background together.
It was growing up in New Jersey. It was an awesome place, right? We had so many things and so many opportunities in this area. You know, screwing around, skateboarding, surfing, you know, playing basketball, playing manhunt, you know, playing out in the woods with trucks and, you know, gravel pits and, you know, occasional trip up to the city to go see a concert. You know, this area was some of the greatest places to grow up, in my opinion. And, you know, our friends that we've had, I mean, you know, are there. And, you know, I think that is something special that we have people that we grew up with that we still keep in touch with and, you know, talk to, maybe not on a regular basis, but, you know, I know that I can not talk to somebody for a while and then pick right up and we could not talk for months and then have a conversation like it was yesterday. So, you know, I can't really complain about anything that we did or how we grew up, and we had a ton of fun.
Yeah, it's a special thing, man. I often will ponder as I consider, you know, now being 50 years old, on the cusp of 50 anyway, and my kids being teenagers. I know you have how many kids you got?
I got three.
So Jay's got three kids. Still living in the vicinity of our home of record. We just had a great time growing up. But I think about the friendships that you have when you're young, and the ones that come and go and the ones that last. And it just seems like we always have had a really strong bond. I don't know when I met you. I think it must have been like, because I was in a different elementary school. So I guess I must have met you in.
It had to be middle school, right?
Middle school, sixth grade, seventh grade, something like that. Wrestling.
Yeah, wrestling. Yeah.
Remember, we wrestled.
Yeah.
I don't know if you got to see the podcast I did with Sean.
I saw most of it, yeah.
He's another one of our crew. And so, same thing, but we have a very strong bond. So it's an honor to revisit our youth and talk about some of those things. And like I said, we're going to get the boys together and really hash that out well. Mm-hmm. So that's our setting. So throughout high school, what was your decision based on to join the military? Why the Marines?
So you can tell me if I'm wrong or not, or if my recollection is wrong, but Aaron, Dr. Drill, he was destined to be a Marine, right? I mean, from as long as I can remember, Dr. Drill was going to be a Marine, and I had no idea what I was going to do. You know, I left high school, and I was working at different car dealerships at the time, and my mom met her husband, Joe, and Joe was a air winger in the Marine Corps. He worked on CH-46s. He was crew chief, and I didn't know what I was going to do. All right. So I was kind of toying around with different things. And Joe's like, hey, why don't you join the military? And around that time that happened, I happened to go with Sean, your previous guest, to your graduation. It was you and Vinny and Z and Greg Smith. And I'm like, wow, these guys are impressive, you know? And I'm hearing some different things. And I'm like, well, I don't really want to go be a groundside guy. That's not my thing. But, if I could be a mechanic, I'd like that, you know? So I kind of went through the whole thing and found out I could go into aviation. I scored high enough. And, it was kind of like, boom, one day I'm hanging out, working at a car dealership. Next thing I know, I'm joining the Marine Corps. And while I'm there, Sean happened to be like a month ahead of me. So I'd see Sean once in a while in boot camp.
Oh, cool. And,
it was something that changed my life for the better, you know?
Yeah.
It was definitely a good thing for me.
Yeah, samesies, man. What was the recruit training experience for you like?
You know, I didn't really go in with this high expectation. And, I watched that movie just like we all did with the why is it slipping my mind? You know, and they had the great boot camp thing, and my experience was so much like that. We had a guy in boot camp, and almost right down to the jelly donut stuff. Like he was there. Like I remember the drill instructor running up the Jacob's ladder, and the kid up there crying. He's scared of heights, and he's screaming at him. And we're on the bottom, and we're laughing because we're like, this is just like the movie, you know. And so that was my experience. It was a culture shock too, right? We grew up in Lacey, which is not a very cultural diverse town. And, you know, when you get in, it's very culturally diverse. And it was just a different experience. And I kept my head down. I wasn't a superstar. You know, I wasn't a slacker, but I wasn't a superstar. I made it through boot camp. And, it was an experience that, you know, I still think about some of the things we did. You know, it's clear in my head, and it was a great experience. You know, I that's what I was trying to tell my son. We're gonna jump back and forth into that, I'm sure, but yeah. I tell him you can make it through. You just have to be headstrong. You can make it through, and if you have the will to make it through, you can.
Hell yeah! So what? When you're telling I guess I remember on some level, I people are patting me on the back because I've got a good memory of some important details of our service. I remember Vinny and I getting in his little beater, it was like a Buick Regal, and driving down to fucking see, as another one of our classmates, I think it was Mike Sutter or something like that.
Okay.
We were so freaking right. We're gonna go down there. Let's take a trip. This is where we're going. Mm-hmm. And so we rolled up down there, and I remember that you know, just driving into this different fucking world with the Spanish moss and the heat, and I forget what time of year it was, and then seeing and experiencing all this stuff that we were going to do, and that day of graduation, right, where they were hoping to someday achieve, not to mention all the pictures of the guys in the recruiting office, like, hey, look at Joe Blow. He's going down there. Well, he's already through. He's coming back. He's going to be in the office on boot leave, stopping by, and all that shit. So you went down. You did something similar, man. You jumped in the car, went down, took that journey. What was that like for you?
Oh, it was fun. Me and Sean and another guy, we jumped in Sean's car, and you know, we marathoned it down there. Like, what was it, 12-hour trip or something? You know, we're going to make it down there. And we get down there and we see this graduation, these squared away guys with this big parade deck. And we're like, wow, this is so cool. This is awesome. You know, I don't know if we even toured Paris Island at all, if we even did any of that, but we just saw like how awesome that was. And we're like, yeah, we're making the right decision. Like, this is cool, you know? And, cause they kind of shield a lot of the stuff from you. You know, you're not seeing the drill instructors up in your face screaming at you. You know, you're seeing the end result where these guys are all squared away, and they're, you know, if you've never been to a Marine Corps graduation, it's something everybody should go to, or at least look at the video online. They're incredible. You know, I've seen two in my life, right? I saw yours and I saw my son's, and they were both, you know, some of the most incredible things ever. And it's, you know, I was very, very proud after seeing you graduate. I'm like, I want to do this, you know. Yeah. And, you know, you're young, you're 19, you're going to take over the world at that point. So, you know, it's a good experience.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. So you get through boot. So when it came to your MOS, you said, okay, I'm going to do my diligence. I scored well enough on the ASVAB. I want to do something that's transferable. You already had a mechanical background. So that was a wise decision. So you said you had some other influence. You said your stepdad.
Yeah. Yeah. So he was in, you know, sometime in the Vietnam era, and he was a helicopter crew chief and couldn't say enough good things about the air wing. And, you know, I went in with I really wanted to go work on jets. That's what my thing. That's cool. I want to go work on jets. But as you know, like, you just kind of pick an area and hopefully you get close to where you're at. Right. So my score was high enough, and I the influences that I had, I'm like, yeah, I want to join the air wing. You know, that's what I want to do. I want to go work on aircraft. I think that would be really, really fun and exciting. So Joe was a huge influence, and, you know, my mechanical background, you know, my family owned businesses in our town that we grew up for years. So I was always mechanical. So I'm like, this is where I'm going to shine. And, you know, for me, it was a great choice. I loved every minute of it. I really did. It was great to be in the air wing, you know, and I know that experience is much different than the experiences that you guys had, you know, being on the ground side. Right.
Yeah. Well, go ahead.
You know, so I'm sure we'll touch on that.
Yeah. So then you went to MCT.
Yeah.
Like everyone back in the day. Mm-hmm. And then where did your schooling take place?
So my first school I went to is when I saw in Tennessee. So we were an hour outside of Memphis, and it's kind of where, for me, where I learned the not so great parts of the Marine Corps, right? Because there was a whole platoon of guys that screwed up while they were at school. And these guys were kind of like, you know, all getting kicked out, and there were so many of them there because we were so close to Tennessee, to Memphis, you know. But the experience at school, you know, it went by real quick. We got to party in Memphis. We got to be rowdy Marines, and it was great. And we got to learn, like, hey, if you screw up, you're going to be like Joe Schmo over there. waiting to get discharged, and you don't want to do that, you know? And so that was kind of, that was eye-opening, you know, because you think you're invincible, right? You get out of boot camp, you're gonna take on the world, you know? There's nothing that can stop you. And then you see these guys that all got stopped by doing stupid shit. And you kind of learn that, like, you know, you still got to keep your stuff together and be responsible and you know, try not to get in too much trouble.
Yeah. You know? What did those guys do? Are you an example?
It was DUIs. They were all DUIs, Aaron. Every single one of them. Yeah. You know? And it's like, you know, what do we learn from that? Don't drink and drive. You know? There was taxis everywhere. You know, always around Marine Corps bases, there's always been taxis. You know, yeah. Spend money. Don't drive. You know? That's what I tell Jake every time I talk to him. Like, listen, whatever you're going to do, just don't drive. You know, and he's real good about that. He'll Uber or, you know, whatever he's got to do. Because, you know, that could really screw up your life. Getting other than honorable or dishonorable discharge for a stupid mistake is not the way anybody wants to finish out their career.
Yeah.
But schooling itself was awesome. You know, here we are in Memphis, right? We're an hour outside of Memphis, and, you know, we get to go to these blues bars and all kinds of cool stuff. And we had a great instructor. It was real chill, you know, now we're an air wing now, you know, this is the way it is. We're chill. We're not getting screamed at. So, it was good times, man. Good times. It was short though. It was like a month and a half.
And what was the school? What was the school for?
It was a basic helicopter school. So that's what I learned. I got to Memphis. I learned, all right, I'm going to go work on helicopters. So it was a basic helicopter school. We learned real basic stuff, you know, and it was really about all the aircraft because at that point, I don't know if you're really picked to go into what aircraft, what helicopter you're going to go into. So we were just doing a generalized helicopter type school.
So you got exposure to all of them?
Yeah, very limited. Very limited. But we did get exposure to all of them out in Memphis.
And what were they?
So we had the Hueys, the Cobras, the CH-46s, and the CH-53s. At the time, those were the main players.
Definitely. So,
it was fun. It was like I said, it was a quick school. And then from there, you know, they kind of send you to wherever you're going. I happened to pick West Coast. Right. So my next school would be when I got to California and I went to a training squadron out there for I want to say it was like 3-4 months where we worked in a training squadron. Don't really remember much of that part of my career because it was quick. It was like a transition period. And then they kind of jammed us into the fleet from there. And, you know, that's where things. You know, I'm sure, like I said, all our experiences are a little different, but for me, that's where everything kind of settled down, right? We settled into work, you know, and you're a boot and you're this, you're that, you know, you're getting hazed, but not in a way that is, you know, we say hazing, right? But is it a hazing that's going to, you're going to go tell on somebody? No, it was like normal getting screwed with. You know, we were too busy to ever really for it to affect us in any kind of way, you know, if that makes any kind of sense to you. So, yeah. You know, aviation, yeah, we're nonstop. We work 12-hour days. We work 7 days a week. And you know, some of the best times, I have countless stories about that we can go on for days, really, and talk about some of those different things, but so I got to California and then I got into my squadron. So, you know, and that was a fun time, you know, real fun time in my life. I love California. Like, here I am, like, going from hanging out with you guys and going surfing. Now I'm hanging out with other guys and we're going surfing, you know, and we're working on helicopters and we're kind of, you know, we're drinking beer because in California in that time period, you only have to be 18 to drink because of being proximity to Mexico.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, all the bars on base you can go drink at, which I think it changed now. So, yeah, it was like the same thing, except, you know, it was all legal for us. So it was fun, man. It was fun.
You said California. So where was the base? What base is this?
I was at Camp Pendleton, and it's funny because that's where Jake is right now. He's in Camp Pendleton. He's in the air wing. He's probably six hangars down from the hangar I worked at, or one of the hangars I worked at. He's doing a different job, but he's still in aviation. And, you know, that's not where he started. In his head, he was, you know, maybe it's too much Call of Duty. I don't know. But he was going to be a ground guy, you know. And we had lots of talks about that and made sure that that's what you want to do. You know, yeah. If that's what you want, Dad's going to support you, right? Because, you know, when you sign that contract, you're a man or not a man, you're an adult, right? Like, this is a decision you're making as an adult. You want to be a ground guy? That's great, you know, and I'll support anything you want, you know. And so we were talking some more, and then he, right before he signed up, he's like, you know what, Dad, I think I want to be in the air wing. I think I want to work on helicopters like you did. You know, and it was kind of out of the blue, and he's pretty happy right now. You know?
That's great to hear. That's great to hear. What, when you selected your MOSs,
mm-hmm.
did you have to select a couple, or did they gave you guaranteed helicopter mechanic? You remember?
No, they gave us aviation maintenance. That was a guarantee. So it could have been jets, it could have been helicopters, it couldn't have been an ordnance guy, it could have been an airframes guy, it could have been a million different MOSs, but it would have been some kind of aviation. And I was guaranteed that, and that's all my guarantee was. And then I think maybe I had another choice. I don't recall. Pretty much got my top choice, and just about everything I've done. I wanted to go West Coast. I got West Coast. So I got everything I picked kind of worked out. I couldn't tell you what else I picked, Aaron.
Hey, man.
Remember.
You're happy where you wound up. So you said before we went live, you said you wound up working on the Huey.
Yeah.
So that was your aircraft.
Hueys and Cobras. So Hueys, we have I was a 6114. I worked on Hueys and Cobras, primarily started as a Cobra mechanic, loved it, you know, great, great job. And, you know, we worked on both of them, but they kind of started us in Cobras. They were a little newer. Then I got into Hueys and I worked on both of those my whole career. Those are the two aircraft I worked on. I also, towards the end of my career, got to do a little flying as an observer / door gunner. So I have some hours doing that. Never finished that, you know, to get my wings or anything, but I do have hours doing that.
Yeah. So,
and I have some interesting stories about that too.
That we can talk about. Yeah, I would love to. What was it like? So you said 12-hour days. What's it like being a helicopter mechanic? What's your average day like?
So our average day back in now let's also remember where we were when we were in, Aaron. We were in the Clinton administration. There was huge cutbacks. A shop that I worked in went from, before we got in, there was about 100 guys in the shop. Okay. When I got in, there was less than 30 of us. So we were responsible for, I want to say like 25 or 30 aircraft. So our work was, you know, constant inspections. I mean, that's the big thing. You're inspecting these things before flight, after flight. And then, you know, the night crew guys, because we ran essentially 24 hours a day, the night guys were repairing these things and day guys would test them once the repairs were done. So we were nonstop. I ended up settling into a night guy because of my mechanical abilities were pretty high. So I did a lot of maintenance. I had some real good guys that I mentored under, back then, and they, you know, showed me the ropes. And these guys were like, you know, they're all pale and pasty because they're the knights all the time. You know, they didn't really. And amazing, amazing mechanics that I worked with and taught me the ropes. And from taking that information, I was able to succeed beyond belief in what I did. You know, I had certifications that guys with, you know, double the amount, triple the amount of time I had. You know, I was a CDI, which was a collateral duty inspector. I was a dual plane captain. And I was actually, before I got out, was a QAR. So I was able to sign off for the final safety of an aircraft once somebody worked on it. So, you know, that billet was usually held at the time by a staff NCO or above. And I was a corporal at the time.
Wow.
Yeah.
Pretty impressive. What does your toolkit look like?
Oh, they were pretty crazy, Aaron. They were just small little toolkits. You know, there's not that many parts on the, you know, they're a lot more simple than you think. So all the bolt sizes were pretty close. Their toolkits were small. And it was really all about making sure that all the tools were accounted for. It's called ATAF. And if you're missing a tool, guess what? You ground the whole flight line. So, you know, it was a big deal. So all your tools are accounted for every single time you're done working on something. And even during, you know, you might, but the toolkits were tiny. If you saw them, you would laugh. You'd be like, wow, you're fixing helicopters with this, you know? And for the most part, we had everything we needed in a semi-small toolkit.
That's cool. That's interesting. Yeah. Keep it simple, stupid, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And how about like arms and armament? What did you have working on them? Surely they gave you opportunities to go out and see what they could do, firing rounds, doing maneuvers, shit like that.
So the Cobras, you just don't see that. You know, Cobras are, you know, two officers. You got a pilot, and you have, I don't know if they had a navigator or a gunner or whatever they called them, but they were both officers able to fly that helicopter. So the only time we ever got airtime in a Cobra was during some kind of testing maneuvers. Okay. So I do have some airtime, not a lot. An amazing, amazing aircraft. Now Huey's, when I became an observer/door gunner, you know, we did some. Those things are pretty amazing what you're able to do. You know, with the missile pods on the side, the 50 cal in the back, or 240. What was the Gal? I forget what the Gal was. I only ever really got to shoot the 50 cal. I tell you what, when you shot that thing off the side of a helicopter, it would shake the whole airframe, you know, insane. And fun stuff. But, you know, it was very limited unless you were on, you know, full crew chief got to fire those things all the time. Observer, door gunner, you know, once in a while you got some, be able to go out and do some stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was fun though.
Hell yeah. What are some of the most common malfunctions or consumable parts on a friggin' helicopter? Like common fixes.
So what we did a lot of inspections, right? And a lot of stuff gets replaced just because the hours that were on it. You know, so airframe hours had every 100 hours they were pulled apart to a certain level. Stuff was replaced just because of the hours and then put back together. For a little while, I ran that shop. It was our phase maintenance shop. And it was just pulling stuff off, put them on, inspecting. Some of the stuff that would happen out in the field would be, transmission, gearbox issues. They had actually chip counters, chip detectors in the gearboxes that would, if a piece of metal would get in there, it would alert the pilots. And depending on if it would clear or not clear is whether the pilots would come back. And then we would do an inspection. If we found too many chips, you know, we would replace that component because, let's face it, you don't want to be up in the air when one of these things fail, because it's not ever good for anybody.
No.
You know?
Doesn't seem that way, no. How about, like, hydraulic fuel and stuff like that? I remember there would always be like a little bit of leaking hydraulic fuel. How about this scenario? If you in the movies, right? And we can talk about cinematic portrayals of fucking. Let's say, like, yeah, I want to hear about that because people, you know, these are foreign. You know, if you're lucky, maybe you've been up in helicopter, or civilian or military. I've been on a few. Usually, they were CH-46s or 53s, which is for the listener, that's a single prop with a 53, right? Big.
Giant blade system. I think they had 8 blades, and then you know tail rudder.
So yeah, like, yeah.
And then the 46 had two main blades, and they spin in a opposite direction. Those things are creepy. I've been on them. You can watch the airframe back in the day kind of twist back and forth. They were kind of really interesting, scary, you know, aircraft to be on. And for some reason, that's the one they always put the ground guys on to go do all your maneuvers.
Yeah.
Scary.
Bastards. Doing fucking, that was the most common, I think. We were doing fast roping or some sort of operation. You know, they got to pick us up, take us here. And they would do that shit. They would always, we'd load up on there. I remember towards the end of my time in service in Okinawa, they had like, you know, the 46 is landing in the LZ down in, Okinawa. So down in an LZ down by the sea. And then, you know, I was the squad leader at the time. So I had to take a knee at the, and count people coming on and all that shit. I'm like, yeah, I'm real fucking bad. Well, cammied up.
Uh-huh.
So 46s, 53s, UEs, fucking. And then there was the, did you ever work or see those damn, they call the blades kind of like do this shit? What was that called? They took it out of service for a bit.
What, the Ospreys?
Osprey. Those are pretty cool looking. What do you think about those?
Yeah, I don't like them. And so Eric, a good friend of mine, was down in Pax River, Maryland for a while. And he was a test crew chief on the four-bladed Hueys and Cobras. And there was a lot of Pax River, or a lot of Ospreys there. And yeah, they're scary. That's all I have to say. They're scary aircraft. Actually, that is the... So Jake works for MALS, which is a like they rebuild components, and his main aircraft that he is working on is going to be the Osprey. So, you know, a little nervous for him to, you know, stay out of them if possible. I'm not convinced that they're some awesome piece of machinery, but I guess they all have their flaws, right?
Yeah, I guess. You know, we like to think, we always remember back in the day, it was always like we assumed that we were getting. You know, one of the big favorite pastimes of Marines is to bitch and moan about things, right? So to each other. And so we were always talking about how we always had the shitty ass gear and none of that stuff. So whether we're talking about helicopters or jungle boots or rifles or ships, they try to keep them in service as long as they can. Imagine what other militaries are fucking doing.
You know, two of Jake's friends went into the Air Force, you know, and Aaron, they say the same thing. You know, and here's the Air Force. Where we know, you know, we've been to Air Force bases. I know in Okinawa, we used to sneak over to the Air Force base to go, you know, get chow because their food was so much better than what we
had
on the Marine Corps base, right?
Big time.
So it was, you know, you hear the same thing across the board, and I'm sure it's just, you know, let's face it, the military, they train the shit out of those aircraft. And it's not that they're bad. They're used, you know, they use them.
Yeah.
Military's hard, and they use their aircraft. I mean, you know, you have to be ready, right? So let's beat them up and let's see what happens.
Yeah. Now there was a recent accident out there in the West Coast. I think you're familiar.
I kind of follow as much of that stuff still, you know, being on some of the aviation sites and stuff I'm on, and some of the friend groups, like, you know, there are accidents that still happen. It's not a, you know, they're not a perfect thing. It's, you have aircraft error, you have pilot error, You have a little combination of both. And, you know, until they are able to look at wreckage and find out what happened, it's scary, though. You know, I've had friends that here's an interesting story. I had an officer I worked for, Captain Bloomfield was his name. Really great. He was my OIC in flight line. And I can't even remember what time period, but it's years and years after I get out. I'm watching a TV show. And at the end of the TV show, it was about military, but it was like a crime drama. Right. And at the end, they said this was dedicated to the life of Captain Bloomfield. And I'm like, wait, what? You know, and now I'm doing searches online, trying to figure out. And he was in an accident, you know, and crashed in, I want to say in Iraq. So, you know, they crash sometimes without enemy fire, and sometimes they get taken out the other way. You know, Right. They're just machines, and we have pilot error.
Yeah. What is the most common cause of this? You know, you said, you know, you spelled it out with mechanical failure, human error, usually a combination, I'm sure, or something.
Yeah. And that's, you know, mostly every time I saw it was a combination, you know, or a lot of times human error, you know, which is, misdiagnosing, I would say weather, right? Or getting caught in weather. You know, I think this last one we heard, what was it, fog or something that took them out or.
Yeah. Well, they just had a shitload. They just had crazy ass, almost like a hurricane out there.
Yeah.
There was a major storm system that hit and they were running some operations. But yeah, it happens every now and then, as things do when you're using that many machines, like you said. What is the deal with weather? Do helicopters fly better in cold or heat, and why?
I don't know. You know, in Southern California, we had that temperate temperature that was kind of the same. They flew great. We never really had issues. One of the things that I know was an issue on the East Coast was icing, right? The blades would ice up. And what the big thing with that was is you get too much ice on the blades, they would get too heavy to spin efficiently, I believe, right? I wasn't an East Coast guy, so I don't know, but that's what we heard on the West Coast, that they would get, you know, heavy because of the ice, and that could cause some issues. So I know that the guys on the East Coast take some different precautions than we did on the West Coast.
Yeah.
But again, I don't really know. You know, and none of my friends wanted to go East Coast. You know, once you're in California, you want to go to California or Hawaii. You don't really want to go to the East Coast where it's cold.
I don't fucking blame them. Yeah, just thinking about some of these, I don't know, could have been like a cinematic depiction, or, you know, the air getting, the density of the air, the humidity, the temperature, something like that. I know that there are MOSs such as like airplane wing de-icer. So I know that ice, obviously it's going to accumulate. It's going to cause things to malfunction, shit like that. So very interesting. So yeah. You're serving out on the West Coast. You mentioned before we started rolling here that you did some deployments.
Yeah. So I, kind of interesting. So I started off in one squadron. And I went to Okinawa. And out of Okinawa, I did a 31st MEU, which was a small MEU outside of, you leave from Okinawa. It's like a month-long boat ride, maybe a month and a half, maybe 2 months. I did that, and I had a great time. I think the first round, let's see, we went to maybe Hong Kong when it was still when it was still English rule, went to Hong Kong, maybe went to Korea on that trip. And then I got back after my 6 month tour and I instantly put orders to transfer to the next squadron going to Okinawa. I really enjoyed my time there. So I jumped into 267, where I ended up finishing out my career and did another tour another 6 month tour and did another Mew with them out of Okinawa. I went to Australia on that one. And that was, you know, the overseas stuff, and I'm sure you know, the overseas stuff is some of the greatest times you have in the military. You know, some of the traveling, and you know, you pop in for a couple of days and you're all riled up because you've been stuck in a boat for weeks on end, and you're there, you're these rowdy guys, and you're trying to find a million things to do, and you're doing all this cool stuff, it's fun, right? Like, that's all I can describe. You have a great time, and hopefully everybody makes to the boat on time so they're not getting yelled at. And,
yeah,
you know, and there's always that guy, right? You're always waiting for that guy back on the
Benatz.
Boat.
That's Corporal Benatz. Fucking, what town did you pull in Australia?
We went to, so it's funny. We're off the coast of Australia. We're all super psyched. We're supposed to pull into, would have been the, maybe it was the east coast of Australia, and we get stuck with storms, and now we're off the coast and the boats are rocking, it is just nasty out there, right? We're rocking so bad that we're cargo strapping ourselves in our bed at night, right? So we're not falling out of our racks. So they keep saying, all right, another couple of days, we're going to wait till the storm. And they kept moving farther north and farther north. And, eventually we're at the top of Australia in a town called Darwin, right? Which is like no man's land at the time. So that's where we pull into, you know, and we're stuck off the coast for probably like 3 weeks, you know, and we finally get to Darwin and they let us off. And it was, not like this fun party town like some of the other places were, but it was, we did fun stuff. We had a good time. We actually did a tour where we went up a river and they have these giant crocodiles that they can manipulate to jump out of the water, you know, to show how they would catch monkeys out of trees and stuff. And, you know, and they're like, hey, you know, you guys just sit where you're at. And, you know, and here's a bunch of drunk Marines running from side to side on the boat, trying to take pictures, and the boat's rocking. And they're like, hey, if this boat flips over, we're all going to get eaten by crocodiles. so it was, we had a great time, and we ended up in Darwin, which, you know, is not one of the popular, you know, destinations, but
yeah,
it was there, you know, cool. It was fun. You know, it was a big joint mission we did with Australian government. And I think that was probably towards the southern part of the island, maybe, if I remember right. We ended up getting liberty on the top part. As I can recall, you know, the best of my recollection.
Yeah. What the hell? I'm trying to think of it now. I got a bar rag from what's their native beer? People, Americans might think it would be Foster's. It's gold. Triple X lager.
Yeah.
We were in Brisbane, which is the eastern side. Okay. But I've heard of Darwin, so it sounds like it's like Crocodile Dundee sort of shit up there.
Yeah, it is, man. It's like,
that's great.
It's exactly what it was. It was wild, you know, just not very populated, you know, kind of crazy area.
Yeah. They appreciate us, though.
Yeah. Absolutely.
They really appreciate it. Good shit, man. Fucking. All right. So you mentioned something about, how about helicopters on aircraft that are on fucking, on ship? So what class ship were you on?
I was on two different ones. One of them, I was on the Dubuque, which was an LHA, I believe.
Yeah.
Which, tiny. I think we had one spot. So we had two helicopters with us. Every time we would launch one, we'd have to pull one out of a hangar and launch it. It was a crazy, crazy thing. There wasn't many of us on it. And, So we were on that. And I think that is the boat possibly that I went across the equator on. Then I was in another boat that was a little bit bigger. We actually had Harriers on it. And I get confused in my head on which one I was on at different times. But we had Harriers on the one boat that I was on, which was what a wild experience seeing those guys take off.
Yeah.
But shipboard operations are, you know, they're hairy. You know, you're working, you're up there on the flight deck and you're, you know, chaining up aircraft, moving aircraft. As soon as they land, you're doing those 12-hour days. And when you hit the rack at night, you're just sleeping and you're waking up and doing it all over again. And, you know, it's fun and crazy all at the same time.
Yeah.
You know?
Now, when you pulled into off coast or whatever, the rest of us, let's say if you couldn't pull right into a pier, you guys ever hop off on the friggin' helicopter? I imagine you guys skating out on a limo real quick. If there's an opportunity to bring you up.
No, they never did that for us. They never would jump us on there and fly us out. I'm sure some of the guys maybe were able to do that. I never had that opportunity where we were able to get out early. And I remember in Hong Kong, they would kind of port in the middle. There was no dock space. And I want to say we would all jump on boats and go in the harbor. If I'm remembering correctly, but there was no helicopter operations for us to do that. So it was, we were getting online with everybody else.
Okay.
Yeah.
You said something earlier about there was an operation where they had to throw a bunch of ballast out of the helicopter.
Yeah, so that was in Australia. That was pretty cool, actually. So we're doing a mission. It's one of my first gun missions in the Marine Corps, and we're doing it for that joint operation in Australia. And we're out there. We go, and the target. The range was clogged up, so we had to wait. So we're circling. Finally, they let us in the range. We go out there. We do what we have to do. And as we're out there, we're like, we're spending too much time out there. And one of the senior crew chiefs is like, hey, sir, you got to look at the fuel. Fuel gauge is getting low. And I guess they, whatever was going on, everybody realized we got to get back to the boat. Calculations were not good. And it happened to be a helicopter that burned a lot of fuel, right? It was one of the strongest Hueys we had, but it burned a lot of fuel compared to some of the other ones. So we're flying off the coast of Australia. Pilots are radioing ahead, hey, turn the boat around so we can just make a direct landing. In the meantime, we're throwing everything off out of the back of the helicopter with any kind of weight, just trying to lighten the load so we can make it. And, it got to the point where one of the crew chiefs was like, sir, you want me to get the inflatable ready for us to go in, And, they're like, shut up, dude, we're going to make it. And they got the boat turned around, and it was like textbook. Like, we landed and we had the fuel truck out there as soon as we touched down. Because if you flame out a helicopter, meaning the engines turn off because there's no fuel, it's a big deal. So we just happened, like, everything kind of happened at the right time. We landed. They got the fuel truck out there as soon as we landed. We didn't flame out, but, we threw out whatever was extra in the back of that helicopter to lighten the load, and we just made it in. It was, it was a fun experience. But scary at the same time. Here we are throwing stuff off the side to be able to make it onto our landing. So that was probably, one of the scariest aircraft thing, because here we are off the coast of Australia. You hear great whites and sharks, and it's like,
oh yeah, man,
we don't want to be in this water. We just want to make it to the boat, and which luckily we did, which was good.
Yeah. What happens when a helicopter flames out?
It's a whole part. Our maintenance manuals had a million different scenarios, and that was a scenario. Like, you had to do major inspections, and I can't recall what they were, but I just remember it going through my head, like, this is going to be a big deal if we flame out. You know, it's not going to be we turn this aircraft around and get it back onto the flight, the list to go out and fly. Like, we're going to have to do some major work to get this thing back up in the air. Like I said, I don't remember what it was, but it was something that was, it's like a bird strike, like major, you know, major inspections to get these things back up and running again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about the, those friggin', I'm sure you had to do those dunk tank training things, right? Where,
oh yeah. Yeah. Where you go into the, that was part of your flight qualifications to even get an observer, crew chief, anything like that, where you get blindfolded, they throw you in a fuselage of a helicopter, they roll you down this big contraption, and, you know, you got to swim to the top. You know, a lot of guys swim to the bottom because you're disorientated and all that stuff. Yeah, did that. That was fun. I think everybody should do it. It's kind of a, you know, it's a good deal. But yeah, we had to do all that stuff. We had little breathing apparatuses that we had that would had like 2 minutes of air in them, that you can use. I forget what those were called. They were kept in our flight vest during any kind of ocean operations. Yeah, some neat stuff, you know, fun stuff, different stuff, you know. You know, everybody I talk to, if I tell them about the military, say, hey, the things you're going to do, you're never going to do again. You know, unless you're some weird job that you're going to be able to do this stuff, but it's once in a lifetime stuff, you know, yeah. And I'm sure you can agree with that. It's a lot of stuff I did was even boot camp. You know, you go back to boot camp, the stuff you did in boot camp was what once in a lifetime, you know, most of that stuff you're never going to have the opportunity to do again.
Yeah.
And I always thought it was like invigorating and kind of fun to do some of the stuff we did.
It really is. What is the purpose? Okay, so you got the rotor up top. What is the tail rotor's function?
Keeps it from going side to side, right? You think about the torque of the main rotor. The helicopter is going to spin. So if you lose tail rotor, that thing is just going to keep spinning in a circle. So it keeps it going straight. It's actually the foot pedals on the if you see in a helicopter, the foot pedals, they make the back tail rotor blades move back and forth to kind of let you go either way, right? And that's kind of what they're for.
It's pretty simple.
So if you lose tail rotor, it's a big deal.
So that's why you always see in the friggin' movies when the RPG goes off, it hits the tail rotor, and then the thing spins around.
Yeah,
they're falling down. What? How about the cinematic portrayal of helicopter shit? What do you think about that?
I think they keep it pretty good, Aaron, to be honest with you. You know, they keep it kind of like, you know, real life on what was really going on. You know, like I think they do a good job for the most part. I'm sure there's people that disagree, but I think for the most part, they do a good job. You know,
that's great to hear. I'm trying to think. I remember fucking like, what's that movie where the Russians invade fucking, it's a great fucking movie, man. See Thomas Howell.
Red Dawn.
Remember that? Yeah. They had that helicopter. It was like all freaking jacked up. And it was like really slow. They had that in Rambo 2, I think, too.
Yeah, yeah.
But that thing is freaking fierce.
That's the old Russian, right? The old Russian helicopters. Right?
Yeah.
Kind of like big, slow, and like crazy looking.
Yeah. And then they hover down. They want to see if Rambo's really dead, and he jumps out of the fucking creek, and he throws a rock, and the guy falls out, and they fucking beat the shit out of each other. That's great. All right, so we're covering a lot of the basics, a lot of information. I think that people find interesting. I learned a lot. How about the notable Marines?
I had some good ones, man, and. You know, what's really interesting, Aaron, is that when you go into a flight line shop and, you know, there is, it's tough, right? You're a new guy and, you get treated like a new guy, you know, you can almost say it's hazing, but in my opinion, it's not, you know, it's just, it's proving yourself.
Right.
But I had two guys that I worked for. It was interesting enough is they were both staff NCOs that came off of, you know, those B billets. You know, I had a staff sergeant Smith, right? I believe he came off the drill field, and a gunnery sergeant Don Miller, who was came from infantry or no embassy duty. And those guys were so down to earth, and they, you know, they were really about the camaraderie of the Marine Corps. They took care of their guys. You know, they had your back during, you know, any situation. And those are the guys that I remember that really wanted me to be a 20-year Marine, you know, because they were the guys that like, hey, I want to be this guy. I want to take care of my troops. And you know, on the flip side, though, you know, you work for those other guys, and I'm sure you've had them, you know, but those two guys, they were awesome. They took care of us. They in so many different ways. You know, Staff Sergeant Smith, he was on one of the deployments with me, and he came off the drill field. So you'd think this guy would be like crazy hard on everybody, and he was not, man. He was like awesome. Like made sure that we didn't get in trouble, made sure that, you know, we had fun, and he took care of us and was a mentor and all the things that you'd expect a staff NCO to be. Right. Same with that Gunny Miller. He was a awesome guy who, you know, again, was there for his Marines and tell us about the stories of stuff that he did and, you know, wanted to see everybody, you know, succeed in the Marine Corps and get everything they deserved and pick the right MOSs or the B billets to go to. Those were two very notable staff NCOs that I worked for. And it's amazing talking to some guys that I was in with, you know, since Jake is in now, like just kind of, because he's, you know, as a young Marine, he's dealing with some of those guys that you don't really want to deal with, right? That are just kind of a little harsh, don't really, are not encouraging, are not, you know, you know, talking to, and he was a sergeant major, you know, and saying, hey, this is not how we want the Marine Corps anymore. You know, he got out probably 3 or 4 years ago. He's like, you know, we want those encouraging Marines. And he even brought up those two guys too, because we both served under Staff Sergeant Smith and Gunny Miller, and how awesome and how pivotal they were to our success as young Marines, you know.
Yeah, it's very special. Some of the guys that do that take it upon themselves to mentor other people. There are some tremendous human beings in the Corps, and every, you know, I think it's part of like there's a lot that goes into that. I mean, I always think about, like you mentioned, these guys came off the drill field, or one of them did. And I think there's something about that, the beginning of the experience and going to recruit training and all those values that they try to instill. And then you get out into your job. And depending upon what that job is, it might be chill, it might be high discipline, whatever, like you mentioned, barracks duty and all that shit. You know, all kinds of different environments you could wind up in. And of course that becomes part of who you are, but God bless the individuals who would take you under your wing and show you what it could be like, you know, the best of the Marine Corps. Because of course, so many guys, they do an enlistment and get out, and they're imagining, wow, is there a future in this for me? Do I stay in or whatever? Thinking about some of the guys in my life. How about some characters you remember? Some real friggin', not these awesome mentors, some real fucking idiots. You know what I mean? You guys have anybody like that?
Oh, we did. We had this guy, and I don't even know where he started out in the aviation world, but he got bounced around from shop to shop, and he was like, you know, kind of the village idiot, but he was just a fun, you know, fun guy. and we would have a great time with him, but he would just get bounced around from job to job because he just was kind of a goofy guy. Now, you know, you got to remember in aviation, we didn't have too many of those because they, you know, the scores were so high to get into those. So we didn't have too many guys that were like, what are you doing here? You know? And even the guys that were that had like the no common sense, like people we grew up with, you know, we're still on that next level where the characters weren't as much as you'd think they would be, you know, there were very few and far between. But there were some guys out there that, you know, they'd make you laugh and they would do stupid shit and they'd get in trouble. And it's like, you know, what are you doing? You know?
Yeah.
I can remember some of them in my head. But there wasn't too many of them, unfortunately, you know. There would have been a little bit more fun if we had some.
Yeah, it's one disadvantage.
Yeah.
All right, so you got that little conversation piece behind you. Tell me about that, the shellback thing, right?
Shellback, yeah. So that was something I did. When you cross the equator, you go through, it's an ancient Navy tradition that if you go across the equator on a boat that you go through a shellback ceremony, and it's pretty awesome, right? And you become a shellback, and that's something they even put on your DD-214, if I remember right. Like it's a big ceremony. And now if you went to Australia, you did that too, right?
We flew to Oakey.
Oh, you so flew there.
Yeah, that's so. When you did that float, was that called a Westpac?
So mine was just a Mew, but it wasn't a Westpac because I didn't leave out of California.
Okay.
Right. So a full Westpac is out of California, and they do 6 months on the boat. So we would fly to Oakey, and then we would get on a boat from Oakey and do 1 or 2 months out at sea. Well, one of the times I went, I want to say the Australia trip, we went across the equator and we did the whole naval shellback ceremony with the Navy. It's a big Navy thing. And we all got to become shellbacks. And I think it even says, March 1997. And it tells you the boat, the USS Dubuque, right? Sure. So, and it's even got a seal from the boat on it, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that's cool, man.
One of the things I kept and framed, I was real proud of that. And, I hope my son gets to do that. It doesn't seem like he's in the type of MOS that's really going to deploy like that, but it was a cool experience, you know, and I know it's something that's, you know, hundreds of years old that they've done, you know, so it was cool. Really cool.
Sounds pretty neat.
Yeah. I
wondered about that. All right, so tell us about Jake. So coming full circle, man, you're a dad, you're a Marine, you're a family man, business owner, you're a teacher, you got a son, your eldest, right? Jake.
Yeah.
At what point does he come to you and say, hey, I'm thinking about joining the Marine Corps?
So, you know, I have a cousin that was in the Marines, and I have another cousin, his brother was in the Army. And, so military is kind of rampant through my family nowadays. So Jake, even from when he was little, kind of was like, I want to be in the Marine Corps, Dad. And, you know, I always kind of told him, hey, I'd rather you try something else, you know, like don't go down that road yet. And then he, in high school, he wasn't the greatest student. And that's where we kind of came to the decision together that, you know, hey, maybe I want to go in the military, Dad. That's what he would tell me. I'm like, all right. So we would talk about it. And he had it in his head. He wanted to go into the Navy and be a SEAL and you know, all that good stuff. And so we got that information. Well, in the meantime, he broke his ankle his senior year. Skateboarding, being stupid. And it was bad. I could send you a video one day. I got it. And so, you know, that kind of put his life on hold. So during this whole time, he graduated. His graduation, he was in a cast, had some surgeries done, some plates put in there. And, you know, so kind of the special forces thing went away, right? You have plates in your ankle and stuff. A year later, you know, after he had that surgery, he had complications from the plates that were in his ankle. They were kind of bulging through his skin. So we were able to get him removed. Well, because he got those removed, he was able to go into the military. And he went through some vigorous, it was 6 months, Aaron, of him trying to, after they came over and did the initial sign, it took him 6 months to get full medical clearance to go in. So, you know, like I said, his senior year, he didn't really have an idea on what he wanted to do, kind of in the same boat I was. And, you know, we talked about the military, and it was really up until the last, I'd say last month, where he's like, Dad, I want to go aviation. You know, I want to follow in your steps. I want to do what you did, which I was all on board with. You know, I think based on my time there, and I'm sure you can agree if you're, and I don't know, maybe you don't, but when he came to me and said, hey, I want to be a Marine, and I was okay with that. You know, I knew it would be a good experience, and for him, it would make him grow up a little bit, and if he did 4 or 5 years and got out, that's great. If he did 20, I'm fine with that too. You know, it was a decision that, you know, we helped to encourage because of, you know, he wasn't really doing much. Wasn't a really school kid. Didn't really have a vocation that he was really into. And, you know, he went through welding school and did some vocational school stuff. But it seemed like to me, and to him, finally, that the military was the right place for him, you know. And he has, you know, he did awesome in boot camp. You know, and this generation's different. You know, they're connected, Aaron. We weren't connected, you know. He's so connected to me. Like, I think I talk to him every day. And during boot camp, he struggled because he couldn't call me up and say, hey, Dad, this is what we're doing today. What do you think of this? You know, like, you know, they the generations are different, right? Yeah. I'm sure you know that. And so he has his good days, his bad days, but for the most part, he really is being a great Marine and doing all the things he's supposed to do. And we're so proud of him, you know, all the great things he's doing. And, you know, nothing else I could say about that. I'm constantly, you know, on the phone with him talking about this guy, talking about that, how to, you know, navigate some stuff. I got some friends who, a real good friend of mine who I was in with happened to retire, and he happens to still work for the government. He works for the simulator. That's like two hangars away from where Jake works. He goes down and says hi to Jake like once a week. You know, he flew out for Jake's graduation to see him graduate, you know, close friend of mine. So it's pretty cool. You know, it's pretty cool to see him kind of going through some of the stuff I went through and, you know, being there and doing the right things, which are really cool, you know?
Hell yeah.
Yeah. And as a father, I can't be more prouder of him, you know, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very special. What was it like seeing him walk across the tarmac and recruit training, Paris Island?
It was freaking awesome, Aaron. Brought tears to my eyes, you know. Awesome. So awesome. You know, I'm my family there. I think we took up half the bleachers, right? I had my family, big Italian family, his mom, some of his mom's family there, and his two sisters were there. Some of our friends that we've grown up with came down, and got some friends from the Marine Corps that came out to see him.
Yeah.
You know, it was just so awesome. Just a different, you know, different experience from the last time I was there. Right. Last time I was there, I was walking across that tarmac. So it was really, really cool. Impressive to see him. You know, the Marine Corps keeps to their tradition. And it's awesome, you know, what, 30 years later, they're still doing the same kind of things. And those Marines still look squared away, and they got their shit together. And there's nothing like it in the world, you know. You know, that's why I tell people, you want to see one of the most awesome graduations ever, go to a Marine Corps graduation. Or yeah, look it up online and watch a video, because it's incredible.
Yeah. It's a transformative experience, man. It's what a special thing. must be to see that. Here you went down, you saw some of the guys that came before you graduate, and then you graduated, and you friggin', you're watching your son graduate, and he's doing the same shit that you're doing. Yeah. Is he giving you any sense of old core shit, like, you know, like how they deal with cell phones? You talk about connectivity, you know, that's got to be a major problem, I would imagine, for, you know, operational security, you know, people looking at their fucking phones all the time. How do you curb that?
You know, I don't know if they have, and I think they kind of roll with it, with a lot of it, and they, you know, they tell them, hey, you're at work, you keep your cell phone away, but how many of them really do? You know, he doesn't call me during work. He doesn't text me during work. But again, he's only been there for a couple of weeks, so we'll see how it kind of plays out. You know, he's been pretty good about following what they want him to do. So they don't want him to do that, so he doesn't do it.
Right. You know?
So I guess we'll see how that kind of plays out. But they definitely are a lot more connected, you know, than we are. I remember waiting on the line, you know, outside the barracks to get on the payphone to call, yeah. You know, he calls me every night. Hey dad, what's going on? And now I'm yelling at him, 'cause it's like 11 o'clock at night. I'm like, hey pal, we're on the East Coast. You know, I can't be up this late anymore.
Yeah. Fucking, awesome, man. Let's talk about, Semper Fidelis.
Yeah.
What is Semper Fidelis? What does that mean to you, having served, having your son serving, being a, you know, a pillar of the community?
Yeah, I you know, Aaron, it's I don't know if it has meant as much as it to me as it does now, if that makes sense, in my life, now that my son's in there. And you know, I've kept in touch with guys I was in, you know, and I've been to aviation reunions out in Vegas with some of these guys, and you know, the always faithful things like, yeah, you're all my brothers, but time fades, right? Time fades. Until this last year, it really changed my whole outlook of that Semper Fi. You know, my friend Rob, I served with the guy for 2.5 years, 30 years ago, right? I talk to him maybe once a year, and he came out to Jake's graduation, which was like huge. Like, here's a guy that I spent time with when he was a boot in the Marine Corps, as so was I, and 30 years later, you know, our friendship is so strong that he's going to come out and see my son graduate. And he's the guy I call, like, hey, this is what Jake's got going on. You know, is there anything you can do to help? And he's like, whatever you need me to do, you know? And, you know, I have that friendship here with my guys, with you, and, you know, I'd do anything for any of you. And you know, my situation, I do anything for anybody. But it just kind of drives it home that the guys that I was in with that long ago are the same way. And that's huge to me. It means you're always going to be there for your friends, your family. And, that's what it means to me. You know, I try to, and that's how I try to live, you know, be there for everybody, you know, sometimes to my own demise, but I do it.
Yeah.
Right.
Can't stop. Yeah. Keep it up. You have any moto tattoos?
No, but I promised Jake once he's ready, matching moto tattoos, man. I don't know, big bulldog or something crazy.
Yeah, bro. Something friggin' serious, fucking EGA, yeah. With some,
yeah, helicopter. EGA. I'd love it. You know? No, I don't have any right now, but I will have it some.
Yeah, you gotta get one. I got mine like 10 years ago for just a big EGA in my shoulder.
Yeah,
it's cool. Awesome, brother. Well, what kind of closing remarks we got here? In closing, I'll ask you, well, I'll tell you something. I'll preface it by telling you what motivates me. What motivates me is in my search of for interesting and authentic human beings to whose stories I will tell, that I'm going through a mental Rolodex of people, both in the military and out. Obviously, the military is a very the Marine Corps was a very powerful experience, which is why I'm starting this podcast endeavor by talking to people who served. And to talk to a fellow Marine like yourself and to see that there's traditions being carried forward, like Jake joining and all that you're experiencing, going down there to see him graduate, and now he's back at, he's out to his MOS and carrying that torch. That's friggin' highly motivating to me, just knowing that you're doing well and he's doing well, and you know, being able to learn a little bit about what that experience is like for you. But what motivates you, Jay? What makes you tick?
You know, Aaron, my family, right? That they are the pillar of what makes me tick. You know, I come from a big Italian family, and you know, my family here. I got my wife, I got my two girls that are living here with us. We got Jake in the Marine Corps, and you know, the support of them is what makes me tick. You know, my wife is a huge supporter of all the things I do. You know, I'm a teacher. We own businesses together. We donate to the community. We do all those things, and it's all based on our family, you know. And, you know, friends obviously are a huge part, like family, friends, like the community, right? Community, we could say that, family, friends. That's what makes me tick. You know, we help out as much as we can. We try to do the right thing by people, you know, and it's not always easy, especially being a business owner. I mean, I'm sure, you know, you're a business owner, and you know, everybody's knocking on your door for something, right? They think they want something from you. And we do as much as we can. And, you know, and we do as much for our family, our friends, whatever we can possibly do. That's kind of how I live my life, you know. What makes me tick now is I'm ready to take the next step in my life. I've been telling my wife for like a year now, hey, it's time to move, you know, get out of this Jersey Pine Barrens thing, and, you know, take it to another step. And, you know, that's my daily motivation, that we're going to be, you know, picking up at some point and starting over somewhere else. And, you know, I enjoy that, you know, just living my life and doing right by the people that mean the most to me. You know, that's my thing.
It's the way to fucking be, brother. Got any prospective places that you're talking about move to?
You know, we really want to go to Florida. You know, two of my wife's sisters live down there, and we were there like two or three times a year, and you know, there's still space down there. You know, and I can still be by the water, which is where I want to be. I don't want to be too far away from the ocean. I like to be able to get there within an hour. So that's kind of right now where we're looking. But, you know, that's going to evolve and change, I'm sure, as things go on. But my wife having two sisters down there is really going to – and they just moved there within the last couple of years, one just like 6 months ago. So, you know, it's kind of a place we're looking right now.
Very cool. Yeah. I didn't know that. I remember you talking something about Missouri or something.
Well, we had a house out there, you know, beautiful place, you know, for the outdoorsman. If you could get out there and visit, and I know you are the outdoorsman, you would love Missouri and what it has to offer.
Yeah.
And, you know, we spent our time there and we enjoyed it. And now we're thinking a little bit farther south. Cold weather is not good anymore, man.
It sucks ass. I know, brother. Yeah. Cool, man. Well, I wish you all the best with planning all that stuff. Got some family down in Florida as well. So, but I'll tell you, every summer we go to visit family in Michigan. That's pretty freaking cool. Michigan became one of my favorite places. That's where, if you listen to the podcast with Sean, whenever I go out there, I always try to hit him up and visit. But it's pretty, it's a different vibe out there. Still got water, but it's the friggin' Great Lakes. That's neat. Yeah. But I got a, I have a, an aunt that lives in the Villages in Florida. That's a fucking hoot, brother.
So that's, so Lynette's one sister lives in the Villages.
That place is great.
Her other sister, the Villages just made a family section. And that's where her other sister just moved. They have their own charter school down there and their
yes.
whole, like their whole community. And that's one of the areas that we were considering.
Oh, God.
Because it's like an hour away from the water, and I could be on the West Coast.
Fucking great. I could see you like tricking out with your mechanic background. I could see you tricking out golf carts and shit.
Oh, Aaron, that was my exact thought like a year ago. Like, hey, let's move there and go build golf carts, man.
Mods, like modify them, you know. That'd be freaking sweet. We've been down there a few times. I actually, because a lot of it revolved around either football or cheer fucking competition down in Disney. So I'd rather be at the Villages riding around a golf cart with the old farts.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
In a heartbeat,
it's
dude.
It's a hoot, isn't it? I mean, they open up those. They have the bands playing in the town square.
Oh, go take it down
your gardens and your
town square.
Shoot your party, man. Yeah.
Yeah. So cool. Well, maybe we'll at least be able to visit if you move down to Villages.
Absolutely.
Sweet. So, all right, brother. Listen, I love you, man. I appreciate your time. I learned a lot about the freaking the air wing and freaking UEs and how they fly and what the toolkits are like and some notable Marines, and you got Jake in the friggin' in the suck now in the Corps. I wish him the best of luck. Semper Fi to him and you, and I love you, brother. And we're gonna get those friggin' character buddies of ours round up. There's gonna be 10 heads on here or as many as we can get, and we'll tell stories about the old day and do a love fest. And if we have any scores to settle, we'll do that too. And it'd be great.
So, all right.
Love and respect, my brother. Have a great weekend.